So this is week five of this course, and we're moving on to the third foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of mental functions. I want to talk a little bit about that wording, mental functions. Often you see it translated simply as the mindfulness of thoughts, but that thoughts is like too narrow. Too narrow a word, because there are things like emotions and moods and more subtle things like we talked last week about Vedana. There's other subtle mental formations some of which we'll look at later on that are also fit into this category. So that's why I very consciously use the word mental formations as opposed to thoughts, because thoughts is an incomplete translation in a sense. So anyhow, I want to start just by reading some of this section of the sutta. And then I'll come back and read some more of it later. So, and how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind? Just that wording in his intention is like, here we are actually contemplating the mind as mind. Well, what does that even mean? Well, we'll talk about that later too. Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as a mind unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. So this first part of this section, he's looking at five general categories of mental formations or mind states. First three, lust, anger, and delusion, are commonly called the three poisons. And then there's contracted and distracted, and we'll come back to those. So the first three, lust, anger, and delusion, are direct results of Vedana, of feeling tone when we don't notice it. You know, feeling tone, something arises at one of the sense doors. Vedana, feeling tone arises. If it's pleasant, we tend towards lust, desire, grasping, clinging, lots of different translations there. If it's unpleasant, then our habitual patterns of mind tend towards anger or aversion, or there's several different words that might be used in the translation. And if it's neutral, then we tend towards delusion, spacing out. That's the habitual patterns of mind we all have. And these are called the three poisons, quite clearly, because these are the mind states, these three general categories of mind states, which have lots of flavors and variations, are the ones that cause all the trouble, or a lot of the trouble anyway, in our lives and in our practice. And in the Dhammapada, which is a sort of collection of poetic brief teachings of the Buddha, there's a line that says, there's no fire like lust, no seizure or grip like anger, and no snare or net like a delusion. This is a great set of images. I want to spend a little bit of time with them. So there's no fire like lust. It's like we're on fire. We want something so much, we're on fire. it's like, and he says there's no fire like lust. So no matter how strong that burning sensation is, it's nothing compared to the extremes of lust. Of, remember, lust is just a desire that's overwhelming. I mean, desire in and of itself is neutral. You know, you had a desire to come here tonight. That was a wholesome desire. Hopefully, anyway. you might have a desire to, you know, you're hungry and you have a desire to eat something because that's a natural thing to do. So desire in and of itself isn't the problem. It's when desire becomes uncontrollable. When desire turns into lust, which is, I want it right now, I have to have it, no matter what. It's like that there's a fierceness to that desire that is overwhelming. No fire. And the word fire is like, because there's heat often involved in the sense of, you know, when you really want something, it's like, you know, you're sort of on fire. You know, I gotta have it right now sort of feeling, sort of like being on fire. Then there's no seizure or grip like anger. Sort of in a sense, the opposite. You know, now instead of being on fire, we're sort of contracted, we're gripped. We're having a seizure. And have you ever seen someone who's really angry or felt yourself being really angry? How that energy of a seizure, like it's, you're gripped by it in a really unpleasant way. I mean, having a seizure is not pleasant, or so I'm told. But even the sense of being gripped by it, like it's this energy has got a hold of me. This mental energy has gotten a firm grip on me. And then there's delusion. No snare or net like delusion. I like the word net, actually, myself. You know, it's like when we're caught in some in a deluded mind state, it's like someone's thrown a net over us and we're like, how do I get out of here? Like we're caught. We're trapped. And we don't know how we got into the net, and we don't know how to get out of the net. That's the sense of delusion. It's like we're just like, oh my God, you know, we're squirming around, or we're just like we've given up sometimes too, and we're just lying in the net, we're stuck there. But it's once again a great image, I think, because it's like we're delusion. We feel trapped because we don't know how to get out. How do I, when I'm caught in one of those delusive mind states, just how do I get out of this? You know, when we, you know, delusive mind states might be like, you believe firmly that something's true. Like so-and-so is going to come and get me. You know, that's an extreme version of it. But it's like, and you get caught in that deluded mind state and it's like your mind just swirls around in that mind state, in that deluded place, trapped. But here's the important thing. Notice what the instructions actually say. And I'll just read a little bit again. Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. So it's not only important that we can see these mind states arise, these unwholesome, the three poisons, but it's also important that we see when they're not there, that we note their absence. If we don't do that, the practice becomes this sort of really, really efficient way to make ourselves feel really bad all the time. It becomes grim. It's like, I'm just gonna, oh, there's some more lust. Oh God, there's some more of that aversion. Oh yeah, boy, am I ever deluded now. And we just get caught in seeing one thing after another. But when we start to see and note those times when those things aren't there, these are really important times in the practice because they're like, oh, I'm not, the thing is, often these poisons have attached to them, in a sense, habitual stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. Such and such a thing happened, and blah, 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 blah. And she said that, and I said this, and she should have said that, and she's wrong, and I'm right. And now, and you're reliving the anger of that exchange you had 20 years ago, perhaps. But you're living it again and experiencing all that anger yet again, which is in and of itself unwholesome. It doesn't make you feel very good. It's very unpleasant. But it's also these stories that revolve around these three poisons become the way we define ourselves. They're the way we create a sense of me. I'm the person who this happened to, and this happened to, and this happened to, and who wants this and doesn't want that. These are all ways that we create a separate sense of self, because they're so familiar, because we've told them, sometimes told us ourselves those stories so many times. We become identified with those mind states, to the point where people say, I'm an angry person, or I'm a lustful person, or I'm a space cadet. I'm just always, off in some delusive state. That's their self-image. And often it's some mixture of those three. It's not often as clear cut as one or the other. But this is the danger zone of a mental process. And so what we want to do, and what the Buddha is saying here, is just to see these for what they are. These are just mental arisings. These are just things, these are mind states. They arise like everything else. They arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. That's the nature of everything, right? Everything is impermanent, including these mind states. And so when we can sort of, in a sense, step back from the story, step back from the content of those stories, step back from trying to figure things out, step back from trying to understand why things are the way they are, which is our whole Western psychological way of dealing with things. And I'm not saying Western psychology isn't sometimes useful. Sometimes therapeutic practice can be extremely helpful. So I'm not dissing it completely. I went through some, I was in some, in my early 20s, involved in some quite intense group therapy practice things. And it was very useful at that point in my life. But it's like, what we want to do is somehow be able to see the mind state, note the mind state, anger, lust, aversion, fear. All, we just see them for what they are. They're just mind states. And be able to note them for what they are. Just things arising. And not be reactive to them. Because often the other layer of this, of course, that is, we, something, some story arises and anger rises and we see, anger. And then we go, oh, I'm so bad. I should never be angry, right? I mean, I'm supposed to be this spiritual person, who never gets angry, right? Nonsense, of course. But that's where we go next. So we shift from anger to self-blame, or anger to blaming someone else, growling, whatever. And so we have to understand that what we're trying to learn to do by just noting these mind states when they arise, and remember, this is part of this larger envelope of things we're noting, all of the physical things, in the first foundation of mindfulness, Vedana from the second foundation. So there's this, if what's most predominant in the mind when you go to note is one of these energetic mind states, that's what you note. So we're not going out looking for mind states to note, just like we're not going out looking for physical sensations to note or Vedana to note for that matter. It's just, if that's what's most prominent, that's what I note. Now, I want to read something here. It's from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. Because this, he's talking about this very topic, and does it, this particular section of his book is perfect for what I'm talking about. By emphasizing the recognition and knowing of the unwholesome roots and the wholesome ones in their absence, the Buddha is highlighting the wise discernment of what is skillful and what is unskillful. That is, discerning what leads to happiness and liberation and what leads to suffering. Although this discernment is basic to the Buddha's teachings, in our Western culture, it is a very delicate process. For many people, it is an easy step from recognizing a particular mind state like greed or hatred as being unwholesome to feeling that you're a bad person for having it, or that somehow it's wrong for the mind state to even arise. This pattern of reaction simply leads to more self-judgment, more aversion, more suffering. It's not a helpful cycle. It's important to understand which mind states are skillful and which are unskillful, not in order to judge ourselves or to be reactive to them, but in order to see which lead to happiness and should be cultivated in our lives, and which lead to suffering and should be abandoned. The distinction between wholesome and unwholesome mind states brings a moral dimension into psychology. This is particularly important because these different states are not only arising in our minds, they also what motivate our actions. That last sentence is quite important. It's basically, if we can't sort of step back a little bit to see and note just the mind state itself, we get caught over and over and over again in that whirling mind. We get caught by the content, by the story, which is, and the story is always, guess what? It's a movie, a mind movie, starring me. I'm always the star. I might be the villain. I might be the hero. I might be who knows, but it's always me. So it's like how we create that sense of me over and over and over again is telling these stories over and over and over and over again. And as he points out so wonderfully, it's these mind states that when we're caught in them, lead us to act out in the world. These aren't just now internal mind states. Now they turn into actions in the world. We growl. We act unskillfully in all kinds of ways based on which of these we're caught in. Yeah. And so the question then becomes, well, how do we notice when they're not there? I mean, how do we notice a negative? And that this is where things get a little trickier, to be honest with you. But there's one really easy way to notice, do that. And one is, because we all do get caught, we're caught in some swirling mental state. We're caught in some story, and we see, anger. And maybe the story keeps whirling and we're noting anger, 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 anger. And, you know, then my knee hurts, I note my knee and I go back and note anger again. But whatever it is, it's like that's the predominant energy. But like all things, it goes away. And at the time it goes away, all of a sudden it's like, there's this sort of calm, still sweetness. That's the wholesome mind state. That's the not being angry mind state. And that we have to see and note really clearly. Because that's what gives us the encouragement to keep going with the practice. It's like you're sitting and your mind has been whirling, and then you just notice, oh, you note still, you note calm, you note not anger, because you've been caught in that whirling story, and then it's gone. Like everything goes. And then you note that absence. Or it might just be you're having a particular sitting period, or particular period in your life for that matter, it doesn't have to necessarily be sitting, where everything is just smooth, clear, the mind is still. You know, if you're in sitting practice, you're just noting and you're just moving smoothly from one thing to the next. And at some point, it's skillful to note, oh, no poisons. Not only is none of them are there. Because that's where our mind is sometimes. We're in that state of unpoisoned mind, still, calm, concentrated, clear. A skillful note might be no poisons. Just to remind yourself that that's possible, that that's part of what this practice comes to. We have those times just as much as we have the times full of all that nonsense and difficulty of the unwholesome mind states. Then, so I want to go on with the sutta here. Then the Buddha mentions two other mind states that are in the sense opposite. He talks about, I'll read that sentence again. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind and distracted mind as distracted mind. What's contracted and distracted? Sometimes the sort of the energy of the mind is contracted, it's tense, it's tight. I mean, the whole feeling of what's going on is like your mind is clenched, it's tight, it's contracted. It's often the result of trying too hard, striving. Like, I'm going to note that next thing, I don't care, my mind, it's like you sort of get caught in that sort of, I'm going to do this if it kills me energy. and it's good to put energy into practice, but sometimes we can overdo it. And that tends to make the mind contracted, too tight. Distracted is the opposite. Distracted is like, you know, I can't even remember I'm noting. I keep this wandering off. It's like my mind just jumps from one thing to the next, and one story to the next, and one thought to the next, and one image to the next, and one is just bouncing around. I'm distracted. This is the opposite of contracted. And what we're trying to do is somehow find this space in between those two. I don't want to be contracted, but I don't want to be distracted. I want the middle way. Oh, here we go, Buddhist 101. The middle way is what the Buddha was talking about, where we don't, we have to apply effort. But if we apply too much effort, we get contracted. But if we don't apply enough effort, then we get distracted. We're not tuning in distinctly. We're not clear. Everything's sort of just vague and fuzzy. That's a distracted mind. Whereas a contracted mind will feel tense and tight. A distracted mind is like all over the place. Nothing clear is happening. There's no sense of anything being checked, held in place. And so he brings these two up because once again, these are things we can note. I mean, sometimes the note might just be contracted or distracted, because that's the general flavor. Once again, it has nothing to do with the content. In other words, we're not now paying any attention to the content at all. It's just the flavor of the mind in the moment. That's what's catching our attention. So all of these things, all of these five, another way you might think of it, and I do think of it some way, sometimes this way, is these are like moods, as opposed, you know, which is a form of mental formation. One form that mental formations take is moods, which is sort of like the underlying energy / vibe, being an old hippie, of what the mind's doing right now. And so that's one way you might want to think about it. So when you sense that there's a mood, a predominant mood, sometimes what's skillful in terms of the practice itself, other than denoting, which we've been talking about, is to drop a little thought into the mind. I actually decide to sort of poke. And one of the favorite things I do in this respect is I say, what's happening? Like, just literally ask yourself, what's happening? Not looking for an explanation or a concrete answer, but just like, oh, I'm going to step back and just ask what's happening. And often that just dropping that question into the mind will give you clarity in terms of the mood itself. Oh, I'm just caught in that angry space, or that lustful space, or I'm just distracted, or whatever it is. So thinking of these as moods sometimes is an interesting view of what's going on in the mind, because often a lot of the time the mind is have a mood going on, you know, where we jump from one unwholesome thing to another, but they're all of a certain flavor. And so this is, you have to sort of trust your intuition, but at times, instead of just noting, it's okay to sort of pause, drop a question like what's happening, or maybe you've got your own, you know, what the heck, or, you know, whatever works for you in terms of a little question you can drop into the mind, and then just pause. Don't do anything for, you know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and see if something bubbles up to the surface. It's like, because that's a moment of, that's when insight will arise. So you have an insight, you have a moment of insight into, oh, I'm caught in this delusive mind state. Oh, I'm caught in this contracted space, or whatever it is. And don't expect an answer, because maybe you'll drop that question into the mind, you'll sit there for 10 seconds or so, nothing, no drama here, thank you very much. Then you just go back to noting. Just go right back to the noting practice. But it's like, give yourself a little chance to sort of see what's happening. So then there's another part to this section of the sutta on mind states. I want to read this to you. He understands exalted mind as exalted mind, and unexalted mind as unexalted mind. He understands surpassed mind as surpassed mind, and unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed mind. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind, an unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. He understands liberated mind as liberated mind, and unliberated mind as unliberated mind. So once again, he's saying you can both note the the presence of some energy or the absence of it. But now we're talking about, I don't like this word, but I can't think of another one, higher mind states, forms of deeply concentrated mind that can arise in practice. And over time, each of these words has indication of a different flavor, or sometimes even a different level of that concentrated mind state. And as you learn the practice more, you will start to be able to actually see these more concentrated, more precise levels of mind arise. And it's skillful just to note that. These are forms of deeper concentration. And I'm not going to say a lot more about this. It's interesting to think of that that's where this practice goes in some ways. These mind states can be extremely pleasant and extremely interesting. They can also be really scary. And if you think this is what's happening, this is where you want to talk to a teacher very specifically about what's going on in your practice at that time. It's important that you have someone to talk to about it. And at the same time, and this is also very important, these are just mind states that arise, they're there for a while, and then they're going to be gone. They're not like magic potions, or they don't mean, oh, well, now I'm a saint, or anything. They're just, oh, look, I've learned to be somewhat more concentrated. These more concentrated mind states arise, and I can experience them. And as you go deeper into this practice, there's ways you can actually learn to use that energy towards bringing up more insight. I'll say nothing more. There's one other thing I want to mention, and we talked about this a bit last week, about the refrain, where in the refrain, which comes after each section, the Buddha then repeats the same sort of wording. And I just want to look at the very first part of this. In this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind internally, where he abides contemplating mind as mind externally, where he abides contemplating mind as mind both internally and externally. That's the first part of the refrain with reference to mind states. What's this all about? Remember that internally means in your mind-body complex, and externally means somebody else's. And so often, even when you're sitting, you sort of feel, this has happened, you sit with people for longer periods of time, you sort of get this sense like, boy, there's something going on in that person next to me. Like you just tune into the energy of what's going on there. So even in sitting practice with your eyes closed, and you don't even know the person's name, but boy, you know their vibe. You know, there's something going on there. And you might have some strong sense of that. So that's the externally. But I think this is much more important if we're being mindful as we function in the world. Because if we can, as we're functioning in the world, be mindful of that person we're interacting with, oh, they're caught in that mind state. Oh, they're caught in lust right now, or they're caught in anger, or they're just really distracted. It can really be helpful in terms of how we interact with other people. This is where mindfulness can be extremely useful in our interpersonal relations. When we start to tune into and clearly note not the content of what they're saying often, or the content of how they're acting, because sometimes there's no words even, but the underlying mind state. And sometimes we tune in and it's like, the mind state is none of those things are there. They're in this beautiful, calm, still state, and we can know that. If you're ever around someone who's really calm and still, it's a very sweet experience to be with that person, as you may know. It's just like, and it encourages us to move in that direction. So I'm not saying it's always going to be, you know, a poison that you detect. What you might detect is something really wholesome. You know, that none of the poisons are there. They're really calm. They're really still. Even if they're acting in the world, they can be calm and still and be acting in the world. And tune into that. And have that be part of the interaction you have with them, in a sense. Like, tune into that and either see how you're reacting to their unwholesome mind state and let that temper how you interact with them, or you tune into that sweet, powerful energy they have and let that draw you towards that energy. You know, to be with someone else who's in a powerful, wholesome mind state is wonderful. And I encourage you to hang out with people like that. And the Buddha actually talks about that a lot. In a lot of the suttas, he talks about how important Sangha is. And that's why Sangha, so, you know, we take refuge in the Sangha. That's part of what that means. It's like, oh, I'm going to hang out with people who are often in this wholesome mind state, because that encourages me to be there too. And I sort of mirror that energy, in a sense, just by hanging out with them. So choosing who you hang out with, in a sense, is a way to practice having a wholesome mind state. And out there in the real world, where we all do live, right? I mean, I'm assuming we all live in the real world. I do anyway. Okay, so that's all I have to say about this. Before we sit, I'm sort of curious if this has arisen any questions in any of you. Before we sit, if you have any questions about what I'm suggesting you do, which is just basically note when your mind is what's catching your attention more than the physical sensations in your body or whatever. Note the mental state itself. Actually, that's just another thing we can note, is note what mental formation has arisen. Noting that it's arisen, it might be there for a while, and then it's gone. Whether it's a wholesome one or an unwholesome one, the wholesome ones go too, unfortunately. They're just as prevalent to go as the unwholesome ones. And we'll talk next week, we'll talk much more precisely about some skillful things we can do when we're caught in an unwholesome mind state. That's what all of next week's talk is about. Other thoughts, questions, comments? If not, we'll just sit and then we'll have time for more comments and questions after we practice. Okay. So then what you want to do is once again, find that comfortable position where you're sitting upright, heart open, solid. Tune into the breath, perhaps. Perhaps I often, you know, actually, if I've heard a Dharma talk, my mind is sort of like, well, full of all this stuff. I sometimes just stick with the breath for a couple of minutes, just at the beginning of a sitting period. Let's tune in. Let's sort of amp up the concentration level, in a sense, just by keeping the practice really, really simple and just noting the breath and letting that be my point of focus. And then eventually opening things wider. Every 3 or 4 seconds, just noting what's most predominant, what catches your attention. Remembering that if nothing catches your attention, if there's nothing that's sticking out, it's always okay just to go back to the breath being the anchor of the practice. And, if you're listening at home, this is when you shut off your computer and sit for a while and then come back and listen to the rest of the talk. So, at this point, I'll once again open the floor. If anybody has any questions or comments or thoughts about practicing with this particular teaching in mind, that's fine. If no one wants to speak, that's fine too. But if you have anything you'd like to share or talk about or a question, let's go right ahead. I can unmute you, or you can wave at me and I'll unmute you, or we'll just continue on from here. You're all so mellowed out of talking. It's, oh my God, he can't be serious, right? Well, as usual, I have a poem to read. Just before I do that, I just want to, first of all, thank all of you for your generosity in the field of Dana over the last few weeks. And to remind you that all the teaching I do is based in that tradition of Dana, where, remember, the word Dana means generosity. So it's not like you're obliged, or there's a certain amount you should give, or you're not paying me to do this. It's the whole process of the Buddha's teachings over 2,500 years has been based on this principle of dana, where people teach and other people then offer something to maintain the teacher, in a sense. The other thing I want to mention is that, remember, the word dana, actually the translation I prefer is generosity. And the thing about generosity is it's a kind of a sweet, wholesome mind state. It has three, it's a triple whammy. You know, there's that mental space of when you think about giving, it's always sweet thinking about doing something generous, right? Then there's the actual act of doing it, and that always has a sweetness to it, a wholesomeness to it. And then there's recollecting it later and, you know, having that memory of that act. Not in the sense of, oh, aren't I great? I was so generous. But just in the sense of, it's sort of that memory makes you feel good. So generosity is something the Buddha taught over and over again. Whenever he went anywhere, just any place new, the first thing he always taught was about dana. And then he'd talk about sila, virtuous living. And then he'd teach people to meditate afterwards. So if that's what the Buddha did, we have to assume it was relatively important. Anyhow, so thank you. There are buttons on my webpage. And there's also, if you're listening to this as a recording, there's a button up on the upper, what would that be, right-hand corner of the recordings page. So I want to read this poem, because we're getting to the point where we're actually starting to experience the fruits of the practice, which is what this poem is called. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, which is a poetry book I keep coming back to all the time, because it's full of wonderful Dharma poetry. The fruits of practice. Despite fervent pleas for ease and safety, there are many days when reality doesn't quite line up with what I'd choose. Breakdown, letting go, surrendering even the illusion of control, breathing into the unknown. Sometimes that is what life holds. Practice hasn't brought an end to pain. I still increase my suffering like a fish caught on a line. My struggles only draw the hook in deeper. But being in reality is its own reward. It's the perfect paradox, the courage to stand and breathe when everything in me wants to flee is as great a gift as the freedom to seek retreat. No, practice hasn't brought an end to pain, but it has honed my willingness to experience the moment and sometimes see perfection unfolding in ways I wasn't big enough to plan, much less predict. Practice isn't about achieving a goal. It's not a means to pole vault over suffering. Practice is my way of looking life in the face and saying yes to all its disparate gifts. Practice keeps me awake when I would sleep and reminds me it's the journey unfolding in this very moment. It's the journey that reveals the truth, not the destination. Couldn't have said it better myself. So I won't. So for the next 3 weeks, the last 3 weeks, so the following 3 weeks, we're going to move on to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is really an interesting section of this practice. In the translation of the sutta I have here, it's called contemplation of mind objects. And that's a bit vague. So basically what happens is there are certain ways of looking at the mind or looking at what's arising in the mind, different angles you can take when you look. And these different, what are called dhammas, different ways of looking, are all ways that take us deeper into the practice. And they're just, oh, here's some more stuff you can note. I mean, that's one thing you look at it that way. But it's a often quite skillful way to look at the content of the mind without getting caught by it. In fact, a lot of it has to do with learning how not to get caught by the stories, the content of the mind. So that's what we're going to be doing for the rest of the course, is looking at, we're not going to look at all of the different mind objects. We're going to look at three of the ones that I think are most important. There's five in total. I can only talk for so long, and then I run out of things to talk about. So next week, we're actually going to start looking at the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Till then, let's just dedicate the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all. It was nice seeing you all. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you. Have a good week.
Thank you.
Yep. Hi. Thank you, Hi, Holly.
Yep. Hi. Hi, Lisa.
And Janice. Hi, Holly.
I know Janice, too. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Good night, everybody.
I'm hitting the end button, so.